From beyond the Beltway, this is Bruce Dumont with our weekly analysis of national politics, featuring occasional injections of rumor and innuendo, all offered up by our panel of political insiders, pundits, power brokers, public servants, professors, and most importantly, plain-speaking Americans from coast to coast. Tonight, featuring commentary by libertarian Bruno Behrendt, Democrat Dan Johnson, Republican Judith Sherwin, and in our second hour, we'll be joined by Mark Levin of Texas, and we'll be talking about the latest things in the criminal justice reform. We talked a lot about that over the last 4 years in this program. We're going to check in with Mark, and we're going to talk about what is happening in the criminal justice field in the Biden administration. No phone lines this evening. We're coming to you from AM 560. That's WIND, the Salem station in Chicago, just a stone's throw from the city, just off the expressway. And again, no calls this evening. And again, if you're looking at your television this evening or your YouTube, you will notice that I have a big bandage on my nose. I had some cancer removed from my nose, Lord willing, this past week. And again, this is what you look like when you have a little nose job, when they drill a third hole in your nose. So I'm kind of all stuffed up. I'd love to blow my nose, but it might be very, very messy. Anyway, that's my nose story. We begin by, I want to talk about everything that's happening in politics. We have a Republican, we have a Democrat, and we have with Bruno, somewhat of a libertarian, but you never quite know where he's coming from. But I want to begin with Robert F. Kennedy Jr. How serious a candidate do you think he is? And I'm going to start with Dan Johnson, our Democrat.
I mean, I think anybody on the ballot is a serious candidate in the sense that somebody may vote for him. I don't think he's, you know, ready for prime time, and I don't think he'd make a very good president, but he matters in the sense that people are going to vote for him, and the fear is because we don't use ranked choice voting yet in our country, he could be a spoiler. I hope it's a reminder to legislatures around the country that we should upgrade our elections to ranked choice voting so that if you get three or four or five or six candidates, that's great. It doesn't mean if you vote for the best, you get to the worst.
He presented a poll this past week and came up with an idea. Basically, he did a series of one-on-one with the other candidates in which, he beats Biden by a wide margin and he narrowly beats Trump. But he proposed to Biden that sometime in mid-October, they take this grand, huge poll that each of them would pay for, and whoever loses the poll would drop out because Robert Kennedy makes the case that he is the only one that can beat Donald Trump. Now, that's kind of a harebrained idea, but you've come up with some harebrained ideas in your libertarian background, Bruno. What do you think of that idea?
I would defend any one of my strange ideas as with the thought that we should be trying more things. What's going on what's been going on for the last 25 years with the Democrats and Republicans both getting crazier and crazier, both sides. I think the left has gone farther off the rails than the right, but, that's my position, that we ought to try different things. And I'd like Dan to explain ranked choice voting next time he has a chance, if you think that's a good idea, because maybe the listeners don't know what ranked choice voting is, and I'd like to hear his details. But
we're going to hear those details, but finish in a moment here.
Right. So what I think is interesting about Kennedy's proposal is that it's a little bit goofy, but it does make some sense. I don't know what's going to happen with Joe Biden, but, he just looks worse and worse every day. And as bad as Trump might be to many, many people in the United States of America, I'm no super fan of Trump. The fact is Trump looks more presidential, sounds more presidential, looks like he's having a better time. He's clearly the candidate with whatever momentum is. He's the one that has it, and Biden has none. So, and quite frankly, I don't know why Dan doesn't like Robert F. Kennedy, because he's more of a mainline liberal than anybody else on the ballot. Biden is a puppet of the worst progressive inclinations in the entire country, and Kennedy would actually be a better president than Biden.
I want to go to Judith, and then we'll go back to Dan. Judith?
I don't know whether Robert Kennedy would actually beat Donald Trump. I really don't think he would, but because that would assume that Republicans who are for Trump would really have to change a lot of positions with respect to things that Robert Kennedy is for and they are not
right.
for. But it is a harebrained scheme. I like it a lot better than this ranked choice idea, because I think with ranked choice, you end up with somebody that nobody really likes. And sometimes the weakest candidate of all. So Robert Kennedy is a very creative, very bright guy. I don't see
how... Should he be in the debates?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely,
yes.
He should be in the debates.
Dan, do you agree he should be in the debates?
You know, I'm open to more interesting debates than just the top two, but I do tip my hat to the Biden campaign for their sort of ruthless move to just
yes.
leapfrog the Commission on Presidential Debates, dictate the terms, end the debate on debates. I think it's another example of how Biden's political team is consistently underrated and underappreciated.
I agree with that. In fact, I think that the media in their coverage of it seemed to be surprised that Biden would make a dramatic move. And the other thing he did is he also accepted a vice presidential debate above and beyond what he wants
he
two
did.
Debates. He wants to control the microphones or have the microphones controlled automatically. Doesn't want an audience. That's okay. But then the very next day, the very next day, he comes up with the idea that his vice president is going to run. I think, and they didn't even give the Republicans time to demand a vice presidential debate. They accepted it. That's pretty sharp on the president's part.
Biden's political team is excellent. Biden's political instincts are excellent. You know, in years past, it's always been this commission of unelected, whoever they are,
yeah.
that's sort of dictating the terms. And by the way, I love the idea. I forget when the first one is. It's in like July or something?
June.
The
June
first.
25th.
Yeah, it's less than a month away, June 26th.
Put aside all politics, just from like a civic perspective,
yeah.
a June debate I think is great.
I do,
you
too.
Know, the fact that, like, waiting for the fall and then stuffing them all in, having one in the summer and one in the fall, I think that's a real civic
advantage. Well, it only makes sense.
By the way, let me just mention something, because we've been updating the Robert Kennedy's ability to get on ballots. And, again, he worked a deal with the Reform Party recently. He is going to be the Reform Party candidate, which puts him on the ballot in Florida. And, again, this is the current ballot access report, which we've given to you every week. Kennedy now is on the ballot in Nevada, Utah, Idaho, Hawaii, Nebraska, Michigan, North Carolina, New Hampshire, California, New Jersey, Florida, Iowa, North Carolina, and Texas. So he is, in fact, he has to be on enough ballots to add up to 270 electoral votes. That's one of the criteria to be included in a debate. And the other thing he has to do is he's got to get 15% in a couple of polls. We do have to break right now, Dan, I know, and we're going to come back, and we're going to let you talk about ranked choice voting as well, which I know is near and dear to your heart. I'm Bruce Dumont, recorded edition of Beyond the Beltway this evening. Hopefully you are enjoying and being very safe in your Memorial Day weekend, but thank you very much for including us as part of your celebration. Bruce Dumont back on Memorial Day weekend. Nice to have you with us this evening. Before the break, we were talking about ranked choice voting, which is near and dear to your heart, to Dan. And before we go too much further, Bruno asked for you to briefly explain it and why you think it's such a good idea.
Yeah, I appreciate it. I mean, ranked choice voting kind of, you know, works the way it sounds, where you get to rank the candidates on the ballot with your first choice and your second choice and your third choice. And the big benefit is that, you know, people are freaked out that Robert Kennedy may be a spoiler and that the majority of voters, you know, might prefer Biden but over Trump, but that some of them might like Kennedy because whatever his positions are and whatever issue. But they split the majority, allowing a minority candidate with minority support, meaning like Trump, to get elected. That's kind of a dumb way to pick people. So the idea that you have to have a runoff election – somebody doesn't get a majority. We're used to that. We do that all the time. But with ranked choice voting, you do that instantly in one ballot because whoever comes in last is off the ballot, kind of like Survivor. And whoever that those voters would have picked as their second choice, that's where their votes go. So you get essentially an instant runoff. And the benefit is just, you know, third or fourth or fifth party candidates running. Well, that's great. The more the merrier. It doesn't mean you get some sort of a random winner.
We've done our civics lesson this evening. Let me be clear. That's not what we're dealing with in 2024. So
Right. We've
given you that background because it was brought up by Bruno. But again, let's come
Thank
back
you.
To our reality and where we are right now. There are all kinds of polls that suggest that a large number of Americans don't want the choice of Donald Trump and Joe Biden. The new labels or the no labels group spent, you know, a year and a half trying to go back and forth, asking everybody and their brother to see if they would be the candidate. Nobody wanted to step forward. That group, which had some pretty big names associated with it, seems to have, at this kind of critical moment in the history of maybe there's a thirst for a third party, they seem to have completely blown it. I think you are correct. I think they blew it because, I mean, frequently they were on this program. I gave them the opportunity to sort of explain themselves. But when it came right down to, well, who selects the candidates, it was pretty much a small group of people in a room somewhere, and it didn't seem very democratic.
Well, it's not just that it wasn't democratic. I mean, I think they're chickens, and I don't mind, given that the two parties have picked, you know, bad candidates. I mean, if you look at Hillary and Trump and blah, 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 and all these people, and it's like, you know, we haven't, the two parties haven't been picking very good candidates anyway. So if someone picks a good candidate in a smoke-filled room, I honestly don't have a problem with it. They just couldn't get anybody to run. I mean, I felt like I should call them up and offer them. It's like,
you
yeah, did. I'll
you
run.
You said on the program that you
yeah,
would have
I'll run. And you know, I'd have some fun doing it. And at least somebody gets to talk about some interesting or new ideas. And the other part,
I'm not sure why the Draft Bruno movement didn't catch on. I thought it was
no,
going to catch on.
I didn't really call anybody or say anything.
It was launched and died on this program within 2
but,
hours.
But I would have done it, and I'd have had some fun.
Let's talk about another person who's in the race, and that is Cornel West, who is a progressive African-American leader for many, many years, well-respected within the very progressive politics of America. Doesn't appear to be anywhere near the number of ballots. You're not reading about all the states that he's popping on. I don't think he's on a state as yet.
I don't think so.
I may
so
be
either.
Wrong.
No, I don't
but again, think
so.
Here's a guy who basically is taking a very pro-Palestinian position. And if he were to get on the ballot in Michigan, he might be able to do quite a bit of mischief in Michigan.
Well, even if he doesn't get on the ballot in Michigan, there's some indication that the voting group that Mr. Biden is enticing with his abandonment of Israel are people who aren't going to come out and vote for him anyway. They're just going to stay home, and that may change. Who knows? Things change on a dime in American politics. So I'm not sure it matters whether Cornel West is on the ballot or not. There's a significant, unfortunately, pro-Palestinian, pro-terrorist, anti-Semitic group which has popped up in this country and seems to be centered in places like Michigan and Minnesota. Mr. Biden's trying to get the
And on college campuses.
And on college campuses, but more diffuse. The places where you're worrying about electoral votes are Michigan and Minnesota. And Trump, I think, at one poll recently was like 1 point down in Minnesota. Now, that doesn't mean anything because we're in June almost.
Right.
But it shows that something's going on somewhere. These people are saying, you know, well, we're not going to vote for Trump, but we're not going to vote for this guy either because we don't trust him. So, you know, if he doesn't have those people come out for him, Mr. Biden has a problem. And they're not going to come out for Robert Kennedy either because Robert Kennedy is very pro-Israel.
Right. I want to go back to Dan Johnson because for those who are longtime listeners to this program, once upon a time, many years ago, Dan Johnson appeared on this program as a very young man, and he was very supportive of a third party candidate. He was a big Ralph Nader fan. So my question to you, Dan, is tell us briefly, how did you move from a Ralph Nader outside the box young political progressive leader? How did you become how did you step into the Democratic tent? What prompted that?
Well, I appreciate it. I think, for me, I like progressive policies. I like progressive politics. And I think I didn't quite appreciate that there's a real wing of the Democratic Party that can be as progressive as you want to be, but to have the humility to accept if you've got a progressive position, it might not be a majoritarian position just yet. And so if you lose an election or lose a vote, well, maybe that's just a sign that you're a little bit ahead of the time and you've got some more explaining and persuading to do until the majority is ready to accept it. All that's a way of saying is that I thought, when I met more Democratic elected officials that were smarter or certainly more progressive than I am, but able to work within a majority coalition to get some of their stuff done, I thought, well, why can't I find a way to be comfortable there? So for me, it was around 03.
You came inside the tent, but 4 years ago, you were a Bernie Sanders supporter.
Yeah.
You found someone that you loved politically within the framework of the Democratic Party. Now, let me ask you, and again, this is open for everybody, does anybody at this table believe that Bernie Sanders was treated in any democratic way by the Democratic Party?
Absolutely not.
Dan?
Yeah. Look, I was a Bernie delegate. I was a co-chair of the state delegation. And for me, watching the roll call in Philadelphia, where every state had their say, and had it gone to the superdelegates, right, then I think there's a fair argument to be made that that wasn't fair, which, by the way, in a triumph, in my view, for democracy, superdelegates no longer count on the first round of voting for who the presidential nominee is going to be. That'll be important in 24. But when you could see the roll call and you could see how each state voted and Hillary won fair and square, the fact that the establishment or the people, the leaders of the party, lined up behind Hillary early, well, that's true. But there was also a fair contest that Hillary won, about 58-42.
Dan, for those people, not just in Michigan and Minnesota, but for those Democrats throughout the country in this primary season, for the Democrats who voted for, uncommitted, they did not vote for Biden. Do they have a role at the Democratic Convention? Take us inside what you think will be the Democratic Convention in Chicago. We know there's going to be a lot of action outside, but could there be a surprise or some element of embarrassment for the Biden campaign on this pro-Palestinian Israeli issue?
It's extremely unlikely because here's how delegates are picked. Delegates are selected in a very, very small D process. It's proportional representation, meaning if one presidential candidate gets 60% of the vote in a congressional district, he or she gets 60% of those delegates. And it reflects, that's why there were so many Bernie delegates in the 2016 convention. It's the Republicans, unfortunately, are not small D Democratic. It's winner take all in a lot of states. They can do whatever they want. Every state's different. So even though Nikki Haley may get 30% of the vote in a given state,
but
all the delegates go to Trump.
Is there one last question, though? Is there going to be a significant number of people in that convention in Chicago at the United Center that are, I would say, pro-Palestinian? They're going to be supportive of what's happening on college campuses. They're going to loathe the Biden position on Israel and the Middle East, and could they create a problem within the hall? Does anybody think that that's possible?
Of course it's not possible.
The reason why.
Judith thinks it is possible.
It is possible. I can't believe we're sitting here talking about this. I really can't. We are living in 1933, okay? This is a rerun of 1933. It's going on the campuses. And we are having a discussion about whether or not the terrorist wing of the Democratic Party is going to take over the convention. What planet are we living on?
None of that is accurate.
None of that is accurate. Biden. Did you hear what Bruce's question was?
There's one question. Go ahead.
And my answer is, first, I'll take umbrage at the terrorist wing of the Democratic Party and accept your apology when you're ready to give it.
But on the other hand, to
answer your question, Bruce, they're all Biden delegates. So the only people that are in the hall are people that are Biden folks. There is no other candidate.
That's a great small D Democratic process.
Yeah, boy, it's terrific.
There was no other candidate that ran.
There's no other candidate allowed to run. Remember Robert Kennedy?
When we come back, we're going to talk about how great a candidate he is. We'll hear that from Dan, and we'll hear some. We continue with this recorded edition of Beyond the Beltway this week, and we're going to take a moment to let each guest explain who they are when they're not here. Bruno Barron, we'll start with you.
I'm a Politico type of guy. I've done a little bit of campaign consulting. I've done policy work for candidates a while back. I haven't really been that involved in politics recently. For the most part, I work for an organization that takes housing in North Chicago, Illinois, and flips it so that the town can become 70% ownership, 30% rental instead of the opposite, which it is now. So we're building houses and we do it Habitat for Humanity does, but only for North Chicago, Illinois. So I basically tell people I flip houses for Jesus.
Okay, very good. You're the sure one. Tell everybody
great
who
line.
You are when you're not here.
When I'm not here, I am a practicing attorney in Chicago. I also teach as an adjunct professor in Loyola University's law school, where I taught courses in kind law and ethics. And this year, I have a bunch of thesis students who were trying to get to graduation, and that's what I do.
Okay. Dan Johnson, go ahead.
Hey, thanks, Bruce. I'm a state lobbyist. Firm's called Lobbying for Improvements. So get to spend a lot of time with state senators and state reps in Springfield, and have a small software business on the side, which is kind of, it's interesting. It's fun.
Okay. We've spoken a lot about Democratic politics thus far on the program. We may come back to it later in the broadcast, but I do want to switch gears and talk about what's happening in the Republican field. And I guess the big news is that everybody is still waiting for Donald Trump to announce who his running mate is, and also the way he's been able to campaign, notwithstanding the fact that he is locked into the state of New York, sitting in a courtroom. Let's first of all talk about just the rallies that he's been able to have, the things that he's been able to do, and again, where you think the public narrative of Donald Trump in the courtroom, how is that playing out in the broader body politic, in your view, Bruno?
Well, I've been following the New York case a little bit, and I don't know what's going to happen in the Georgia situation. I don't know what's going to happen with the documents case. But the New York case, if you start reading the analysis that people have been talking about, it's the most obvious, worthless lawfare case of the whole lot. And I think the Democrats made a huge mistake doing it, because they've essentially, like, they already have a very bad optic problem making it look like, oh, we're going to get this guy no matter what, and we're going to sue him everywhere we can for everything that's been done for the last 20 years, even things that aren't even crimes and we haven't figured out a crime for yet. And this one was the one that was a mistake. And then, you know, the other thing that's in the news is that Trump has this rally in the Bronx of all places, and people forget that Trump is probably the most moderate Republican that's ever been running as a Republican ever. And he used to be a moderate Democrat. And the guy knows how to work a crowd from that situation. And no one saw him coming in 2016 when he took three states that he wasn't supposed to. And no one sees what's coming now. And then they have all of this stuff that they don't understand what's going on in the backdrop of potentially the worst Democratic nominee you could possibly have in a feeble old man that can can barely speak properly unless they shoot him full of adrenaline.
Judith Sherwin, your assessment of what Bruno just said.
It's close to perfect, all right? What a mistake to take Donald Trump, an inveterate New Yorker. He loves that city, I think, more than he loves anything. Right. I mean, New Yorkers are like this, and they love him. I heard a guy talk before the rally yesterday, a black guy. He says, this place is great. We've got blacks. We've got Hispanics. We've got these gorgeous women. White women, black women, this is perfect. It's like being at the Yankee game, and we're all together rooting for the country. That's Donald Trump, and that's New York. Those people love him because he is the New Yorker. They loved what he did. They've turned him loose in New York, and he's whipping it up.
Are those people on the jury? The people that you've just talked about, are they on the jury? Have they been following this case?
Well, obviously not. The people sort of on the jury.
It's sort of a complicated. It's a very simple case. In another way, Judith, it's a complicated case when the news media summarizes what happened in the trial each day. I think eyes glaze over when they start talking about this stuff, and people just say, the hell with it.
Okay. They say, Can I go first?
Yes.
Well, I think you asked me.
Judith is going to finish.
Okay.
And then we're going to go to Dan.
Sure. Number one, the people in the Bronx aren't on the jury because the people on the jury are from Manhattan.
Okay.
So the people on the jury, there may be one or two people on that jury who are actually listening to what's going on in that courtroom. The only case that's pretty much been put on at this point is the prosecution's case. And every single witness has undercut the prosecution's case. They all sound like they're testifying for Donald Trump. Nobody has connected him to doing anything. Michael Cohen has been turned into not just a liar, but a thief. Of course, MSNBC thinks that makes him a perfect witness, and it's perfectly okay to steal from your employer. But, you know, normal people don't think that, all right? So I'm hoping that there are a couple of normal people sitting on that jury, and that even in Manhattan there are people who like New Yorkers and who have been reminded that Donald Trump is the quintessential New Yorker, and perhaps at least one or two who are going to say, no, we're not doing it.
Good point. Dan Johnson, go ahead.
It's hard to take seriously the idea that Donald Trump's got the presidential momentum and looks ever more presidential when in the same week Joe Biden's playing three-dimensional chess with a state dinner for Kenya to ensure American interests are advanced in Africa. Donald Trump's stuck in a Manhattan courtroom on yet another trial as the most corrupt nominee in a century. If you think the continued 30% support for Nikki Haley, even though she dropped out months ago, any Republican voter with a shred of honor or decency recoils at the notion that this corrupt grifter has any business being the commander in chief.
Okay.
Or any sort of.
Dan, let me follow this. You have described Donald Trump as a corrupt grifter, okay? There are many people, tens of millions of people in the country who would agree with that assessment. There's also a large number of people who totally disagree with that. So my question, and you brought up the name Nikki Haley, and you brought up a very important part of what Donald Trump must do. Donald Trump, even though he's been the nominee for quite some time, even though it's not official yet, in all these recent primaries, Nikki Haley is getting anywhere from 18 to 20% of the vote, people voting for her, not for Donald Trump. So in my view, as a semi-armchair, political analyst, he needs a portion of her vote. And the fact that she now has said something nice about Trump, albeit sort of a tepid endorsement of him, I think it makes her, and again, for the last several weeks I've said I thought Marco Rubio would be a good running mate. I'm here tonight to say I think Nikki Haley would be a great running mate, because Nikki Haley may be the only person who could save a portion of the people who voted for her and keep them in the Republican fold in the fall, and he is going to need those people if he wants to get elected president. He's not just going to do it by expanding his support within blacks and the Latino community.
Right. Okay, so those Biden Republicans are a real thing. Well, they're real Biden Republicans, and those are people that the character of Donald Trump, that's a bridge they cannot get over. And if there's anybody that could maybe bridge that gap, Bruce, I think Nikki Haley would be probably the best move he could make.
Judith Sherwin wants to digress.
Yeah, I mean, I don't agree with that.
Which part don't you agree
with? I don't agree that Nikki Haley is the best possibility.
Who is?
J.D. Vance, perhaps. Okay. I still like Tim Scott. But I don't agree that those never Trumpers are going to vote for Biden. They may not vote for him, for Trump, but they may not vote for anybody. They may sit on their hands like the people in Minnesota and Michigan, okay? Or they may vote for Robert Kennedy. And if they do that, you know, we'll see how that goes. But there are going to be Democrats who vote for Robert Kennedy, too, because who wants to vote for a guy who can't put two sentences together and find his way off the stage?
The interesting thing is that it's fascinating listening to Dan and some of the other Democrats that are on here have their very, very good talking points about how horrible Trump is and how corrupt he is. He's currently leading Biden 47-46. He's outpolling Democratic. I mean, he's outpolling other Republicans in Senate states and competitive Senate states. The guy, you can say what you want. He's looking stronger. Not like climbing rapidly, but he's looking stronger every day, and Biden is looking weaker every day. And three-dimensional chess having to do with Kenya isn't doing anything for anybody. That rally in New York was a real thing.
That's three-dimensional chess, the rally in Bronx.
As a I get it. Kenya's not going to help.
Dan, as the politician.
10,000 people in the Bronx. Okay.
Say that one more time.
Oh, I get it. Being one of the best president in a generation, certainly on foreign policy, shies in comparison to 9,000 people showing up in the Bronx.
Biden is the worst president.
He's leading us to World War III.
But 50% of the people don't agree with what you just said.
He doesn't know that.
Bruce Dumont back. We continue with this recorded edition, Memorial Day edition of Beyond the Beltway. Dan Johnson, during the break, our other guests were casting aspersions on your ability to deal with reality when you said the things that you said about the president.
Him being one of the best presidents in our generation? Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. Well, I'm going to give you 30 seconds to make your case. Go.
Sure. A booming stock market, highest wages we've seen in a generation, first substantial gun control legislation passed in 30 years, first infrastructure package passed in, 20 years, an incredible onshoring boom led by the CHIPS Act, the Inflation Reduction Act, the biggest climate investment we've ever seen.
Okay. Stop for a second. Okay, you get that. 30 seconds. Now
I'm about halfway.
Bruno, you wanted to jump in first, so we're going to go to you.
Well, first of all, a lot of the stuff that's mentioned is just the standard stuff that government does over time, and both sides have done it. Biden barely changed any of Trump's protectionist plans. He's even getting more protection.
Wait, I'm sorry, can I stop there?
No, you can't. You had your 30.
Bruno, yeah. And then we're going to go back to you.
You had
Bruno.
Your 30 seconds. Let me, okay. And, you know, you, and look, we can nickel and dime this stuff all we want and say, well, there was this bill and there was this backward smoke bender in it. Now, this is nonsense. This is not the greatest. This is not the greatest president ever. He's barely cognizant of what's going on. He's got a team that's running the country, not him. And you've got massive problems with immigration. You've got a huge border problem. And here's the other kicker. This economic stuff is absolutely horrible. I saw this graph. I'll send it to you, Dan. Household net worth climbed wonderfully under Trump. Household net worth went down under Biden because of one thing and one thing only, and that is the massive unnecessary inflation, which is still causing problems for people. And the numbers are obvious in this one simple fact, and that is that you look at any poll, people who hate Trump, people who love Trump, people who are moderate, whatever, everybody thinks that the economy was better under Trump than it was under Biden, and okay. Everybody thinks Biden has done a bad job in the economy, and they can't all be wrong, and they can't all be Democratic consultants okay. who have talking points.
Okay, 10-second response to you, Dan, then I'm going to go to a different topic.
What, I don't get to say
the anything? Idea that oh, these are standard things government does over time. No, that's the incredible excellence of a president who can actually pass legislation like infrastructure.
No one thinks
that's
that.
Not easy to do.
Nobody
it
thinks
takes
that.
Somebody who is excellent at the job to do it. That's why Trump
here is
he's
a
just
question.
Not that good at the job.
Here is a question for our Republicans and our Libertarian. Judith, this is for you.
Thank you.
As a political move, I know you don't like the move, but as a political move, mm-hmm. was it brilliant on the part of Joe Biden to figure out a way to give forgiveness for college loans, notwithstanding what the Supreme Court said? Does that not move the needle and move millions of people who might be independent or on the borderline or maybe not be big fans of Joe Biden, does it move them to the Biden column come November? And is that a political plus? Yes or no?
No.
Why not? You don't see the political plus of that.
Well, first of all, you've got a president who has basically told the Supreme Court to go jump in the lake because what he's done is not at all different from what they told him he couldn't do. That's the first thing.
I'm thinking of politics, Judith.
Well, you're thinking of politics. That's part of politics, too. We need a president. The commander-in-chief, the executive, is supposed to see that the law is faithfully executed.
Okay.
He's not supposed to see that if he wakes up one morning and he wants to get 10 more votes, he takes money from one group and gives it to another, which is precisely what he did, okay?
Bruno,
and
it's do you not see that doing, as a plus
wait,
or
let
a
let
minus?
Let me finish. He's
just,
not,
no, I don't hear Bruno, and then we'll come back to you.
I think it's mostly a wash. I mean, look, one of the things we know about this electorate and we know about 2024 is that a huge number of people, you know, no one wants 85-95% have already made up their minds of who they're going to vote for and what they're going to do.
I agree.
So at the margin, like, again, is this going to get them a few more votes at the margins? Well, yes, it might, but then if you start, like, even the youth vote is starting to
right.
soften up
Thank you.
On,
right.
On Biden. Biden. So, you know, the guy's got troubles, and has his president been a complete and utter disaster and worst president ever?
Quick question today. Dan, on the other side of that, do you worry that all the people out there that never got a college loan are going to be pissed off at this president for giving a benefit to college students? And they're not,
particularly in today's climate,
or they've paid for it already, or they never went
to
college.
I think there are people like that, no doubt. I think the people that have, you know, suffered under incredible student loan debt are in a different generation. I think most of the people my age and older didn't face the same crippling debt that people younger than me did. And it's just not right and not fair to them. But I would say on net, it is a political benefit to the Biden administration. But there is a cost. There's a political cost, no doubt.
Judith.
You know, I mean, yes, there's quite a big political cost. And quite frankly, the young people are abandoning Biden for a variety of reasons. And they're not allowing their votes to be bought. Okay, that's just not happening. I mean, you could also say
what's moving them?
what's moving them.
Is it Biden's age?
Yeah, I think it's Biden's age. I think it's they're looking at another guy who's – they're looking at two other guys, okay, a very smart, energetic Robert Kennedy, and they're looking at a very energetic, kind of funny, interesting guy named Donald Trump who's very entertaining and who does have some very good ideas for their future. They want to buy a house. They want to have a family. Okay. Okay. Donald Trump talks about that.
Okay. On that note, we want to say thanks to Judith Sherwin. She has joined us in hour number one. Bruno Barron has joined us in hour number one. Dan Johnson has joined us for hour number one. We're going to say farewell to Dan because we're moving into a different topic of discussion. In our second hour, we're going to be joined by Mark Levin, not the radio TV talk show host and conservative pundit. This Mark Levin is a Texas criminal justice expert. He will join us, and we're going to talk about criminal justice in the United States. Is it getting better or worse? I'm Bruce Dumont. Don't go away. This is Bruce Dumont. We continue with hour number two of Beyond the Beltway on this Memorial Day weekend. Thank you very much for spending a portion of your Memorial Day with us, and hopefully whatever you've got planned for tomorrow, enjoy it, but drive safely and be careful. And again, for those that are just tuning in to this portion of our show, let me just mention that obviously I've got a big Band-Aid on my nose. I had some skin cancer surgery this past week, and this bandage just hopefully will be gone, and that third hole in my nose will be covered up. It looks very weird to have a third hole in your nose. But anyway, that's why I'm wearing the bandage tonight. Again, Judith Sherwin, she is our card-carrying Republican. She's in the studio with us right now. Bruno Barron continues from hour number one. He is a libertarian, and we've said farewell to Dan Johnson. Not anything politically astute, but again, we wanted to focus attention on our special guest who joins us from the great state of Texas, and he is Mark Levin. He's not the Mark Levin that you listen to on the radio and watch on TV, but he is with the Texas Criminal Justice Council, and he's the chief policy officer. And again, Mark, welcome back to Beyond the Beltway. It's nice to have you with us.
Oh, great to be with you.
Also, for those that have watched or listened to this program for the last several years, you know that criminal justice reform is a personal interest of mine. I've been interested in it for many, many years. And during the Trump administration, we spent many an hour on this program talking about criminal justice reform. And I think criminal justice reform was one of the big positives that came out of the Trump administration. But since that time has come and gone, I wanted to go back to Mark Levin and ask him to kind of bring us up to date. When criminal justice reform got off the front pages of the newspaper and the leads on the network news every night, Mark, what's been happening in your field? You're the chief policy officer. You watch this stuff professionally. Is it on the back burner, or is it still simmering?
Well, as you know, I started the Right on Crime Initiative, and then I joined the Council on Criminal Justice in January of 2021. And since that time, it's been a minute. It's been several years, and a lot transpired in 2020, too, as you'll recall. And we basically, of course, in terms of crime, there was an uptick in the second half of 2020 and 2021 that really changed the landscape. And then since then, crime's actually been declining, even though most people think it's still going up. But nonetheless, no one doubts it's a serious problem, and we need solutions that, reduce crime and also provide for second chances and reintegrating people into society. So I think there's still a bipartisan consensus that we want to reduce crime, we want to spend as little money as possible, and we want to get better outcomes for people and families in terms of you know, workplace and getting people employed, and keeping families together and providing redemption opportunities for people.
Now, one thing you reported throughout your many appearances on this program during the Trump administration, you basically were telling the story of a lot of very positive things in the far as reform is concerned that were happening at various states. And then a lot of that was making its way up to the White House, where Jared Kushner had a personal interest in the subject and working with you and many other leaders in the right on crime field. It led to the passage of Trump's, Criminal Justice Reform Act. So my question to you is, when that stopped, when Jared Kushner left the White House and all the people that were working at the White House on that subject and Trump, they all went away. You were obviously still there. Reformers were still there. There were things that were happening at state levels all over the country in a plus or minus way. But again, did that continue? Did that outside 50-state incubator in criminal justice reform, did that still percolate or did it go away?
No, it's still happening, and I'll give you a really good example. The independent prison oversight idea, which is to say, you know, corrections agencies shouldn't be foxes guarding the hen house, and I'm sure you've read about it all over the country, including in the Federal Bureau of Prisons, people that, you know, have been raped, otherwise abused, and just, terrible deficiencies in healthcare where people die of neglect. And so what happened is actually last year, Glenn Youngkin signed an independent prison oversight bill into law in Virginia, which was bipartisan. Then Maryland did it. And now the U.S. House, with just two votes against it this past week, passed independent prison oversight. And so that's a perfect example of
what
yes,
that
we
do?
Are continuing.
What does that legislation do?
Well, in this case, it gives the inspector general, power to, more so than is the case now, to, inspect and insist on changes to remedy problems at the Bureau of Prisons. And, of course, the state legislation actually is a bit stronger in terms of creating an ombudsman, independent ombudsman. And so the idea is obviously when you have the head of a correctional agency, and many of them are, I know a lot of them, they're really hard workers and mm-hmm. and aiming to test, but they're under a lot of pressure, whether it's from not wanting to be legally financial judgments when the truth comes out about what happened. So there's liability issues. There's also, of course, prison guards unions and they have their own interests. And so there's a lot of pressures on them. And so the idea is really to have an independent lens of accountability to make sure that there's sunlight from the public's perspective of what's going on behind bars.
One thing that came out, at least as the public narrative of criminal justice reform during the Trump administration, and I want you to tell me whether you think this narrative is accurate or not. But again, Trump allowed a lot of people out of prison. For whatever reason, a lot of people were let out of prison. Number one, is that true? And secondly, do we know how many of the people that were let out under Trump or his administration, how many of those have come back and have become recidivists?
Well, I'm so glad you mentioned that because the council, we did an independent analysis of the people released earlier than they would have otherwise, and on average like 7 months earlier under the First Step Act, which, of course, was signed by President Trump. And what we found is we compared apples to apples, people that of the same risk profile as those that, were in the control group. And we found that recidivism significantly lower for people that were released through the First Step Act. And by the way, there was also COVID releases that Barr started, Attorney General Bill Barr in his memo, and he's no softy on crime, as you know, and that continued under the Biden administration. And those recidivism rates have been just a few percent, really. Now, there was a really intensive screening process to identify those people that were of the least risk to the public. The data is really encouraging, actually. And part of this goes to what we know about the fact that people age out of crime. For the most part, there's some really notable exceptions. But crime is generally a young man's game. And so we're still across the country locking up a lot of people who are in their 60s, 70s, who are no threat at that point in time and have been in prison decades. And so there's still a lot of opportunities there. And you know, I think it's fair to say there's also people who were released from jail, you know, who were just arrested for a serious violent crime that mm-hmm. are on a crime spree that really should be in jail. Yep. So, but we're spending some of the money in the wrong place.
Mark, we got to pause. So we got more questions. When we come back, we're going to continue our conversation with you. Bring our guests in Chicago into the conversation as well. I'm Bruce Dumont. Thanks for joining us on Memorial Day weekend, 2024. We continue with Beyond the Beltway and Bruno Barron, our libertarian. He's got a question for you, Mark.
Hey, Mark. So I like a lot of the stuff that you're saying, and I'm a big fan of not only criminal justice reform, but also police reform in terms of the government, prosecutorial, law enforcement complex becoming smarter and fairer and not making as many mistakes. So, for example, letting people out of prison who shouldn't be there because they're not really a threat to society is a good thing, but that's as long as we start building more prisons and take the people who do belong in prison and start putting them there, because I'm kind of a hawk on some of this stuff too, and I'd like to get your perspective on some of this. So, you know, a couple of things that you said, and I'd like your answer on them, is this idea that crime is declining. I'm not worried about those statistics as much as I am looking at the stuff that's going on in some of these progressive cities where they've essentially legalized crime, and now you're seeing all kinds of horrible, horrible things happening, gangs walking into Home Depots and just, you know, brandishing guns and grabbing tools and stuff like that. The kind of stuff that happens when you've gotten rid of things that actually worked, like broken windows policing, although there might have been some abuses. So I'm just trying to get a sense of, like, let's fix the criminal justice system so that we aren't doing stupid things like putting non-dangerous people in prison, so that we can take dangerous people and put them in prison, because a good number of them do belong there. And I'd like to kind of get your perspective on that take.
Mark?
Absolutely. Yeah, locking up the people we're afraid of, not those we're mad at. And in terms of the shoplifting, we did a report on that at the council as well. And what we found is it's not so much that shoplifting's increasing, because it, you know, it's ebbing and flowing, but and the number of incidents has actually been declining in the last year or so, but the amount stolen in each incident has been going up significantly. And that's why it makes sense to have laws specific to organized shoplifting, which you're talking about, not a 14-year-old stealing a candy bar. We're talking videos that everybody has seen of these major operations clearing out tens, hundreds of thousands of dollars of merchandise in some stores. Yeah. So that's part of the challenge of the criminal justice system, is making sure we kind of make distinctions based on the case and do an individualized assessment of every person. And thankfully, we have instruments that enable us, both through an interview and looking at their record of prior crimes and such, to figure out the degree of risk that they pose.
Judith Sherwin, she's an attorney, and she has a legal question for you.
Yeah, you know, I mean, that's precisely what the First Step Act was kind of supposed to do. We were supposed to take a look at people who were not necessarily a danger to society anymore, or probably never even were a total danger to society, and got these huge sentences. So it was a mechanism to reduce their sentence. But as I'm sure you know, recently the Supreme Court narrowed the eligibility of various offenders to be able to apply for either a lower sentence or a reduction in the sentence that they're currently serving under the First Step Act. And I was wondering what you have to say about that.
Yeah, that was that case that hinged on whether and means and or and means or.
Right.
I think it was one of the that they may have been right in terms of what the intent was, but a literal interpretation would have led to a different conclusion. But
well, the purpose of the act was undercut, I think, by the decision. I mean, I would think you would agree with that, right?
Well, I think that, you know, more people should have been eligible. Absolutely. And I'll give you a specific example. So in order to get it through the Senate, the provision saying people could earn time off by completing programs, recidivism reduction programs in prison, had to be limited to low risk individuals. And it actually is more important to get people that are higher risk. I mean, obviously there's people at the extreme end, people that the act rightly said were ineligible, terrorists, murderers, and so forth. Right. But people that had a fence that would allow them to be eligible, but had a risk level that was medium or high, cannot earn time by completing programs. And they're some of the ones that need it the most. So when I first started the meetings with Jared Kushner, and I was in like five or six meetings with him, one of the ideas that I said at the beginning we needed to do was to have a individualized reentry plan developed as soon as possible after someone's incarcerated. And that there has been progress made in that direction because, of course, you want to figure out what skills do they have? Who are the resources for them after they leave prison? Is it going to be a relative? Is it going to be a minister? And those people should be part of the visitation and communication with them while they're incarcerated. And, I mean, we still have a long way to go on this. I visited prisons in Germany and Norway. They have a probation officer come in several months before their discharge, and they arrange jobs, housing. I mean, and no wonder they have very low recidivism rates. Their system's not perfect by any means, but there's definitely things we can learn from, including that type of almost reach-in approach to make sure people get off on the right foot when they leave prison.
One thing, there are a lot of people listening to this program this evening, and when they hear the name Jared Kushner, they go bananas. They can't believe it. They think of every negative thing that people have said or written about him. But historically, from someone who was involved in sort of the sausage making of Congress, could the First Step Act, could that have been enacted without the White House involvement and Jared Kushner's basically lobbying the President of the United States on this, or is that just an overstatement of his role?
No, on this, he did not exaggerate. Jared did not exaggerate in his book his role in this. He said in the first meeting, like, I think there's a 70 or 80% chance I could convince President Trump of this, and certainly he was able to do that. And then President Trump, as I think many of you may know, I mean, he called Leader McConnell at the time, because McConnell wasn't enthusiastic about it. It divided the caucus to some degree, mm-hmm. even though it ended up with, like, I think 86 votes or something. So he leaned into it. And Rick Perry, who was then Secretary of Housing Secretary, or not Energy Secretary, Perry made calls and really worked it, because a lot of the elements in there built on what we had done in Texas in terms of strengthening alternatives to incarceration and reentry. So I think that it's absolutely the case that Jared was instrumental, and then the president really leaned in himself.
Mm-hmm. Now, since that time, we have had at least a perceived rise in crime in many major jurisdictions in the United States. If you watch the news, virtually all of the news is crime related. Certainly that's, from the third largest market where I watch television every night, that certainly is the perception. So my question to you is, with all the wind that was at your back during the Trump administration, and now we have crime rampant in the streets, at least that is a perception, is there a move to lock more people up, build more prisons? Is the pendulum about to swing the other way?
Well, I think there's definitely been mixed trends in this regard. And I would argue that a lot of reforms are very much consistent. I mean, the only reforms I can support are consistent with public safety. Obviously, you know, we've all heard of defund the police and, you know, those sort of fringe things. But, right. You know, I'll give you an example. The Victim Act that's pending in Congress would give states grants to improve their clearance rates for crime. So the clearance rate for homicide in 1950s was about 90%. Now it's closer to 50%. The clearance rate for non-fatal shootings in Chicago is about 10%. For property crimes, it's sometimes in the single digits. And so now if we cleared more homicides and more non-fatal shootings, we would there would be, those people would be going to jail and prison. But I think that's good. Now, if we cleared more of them, I also think we'd have more of a deterrent. So we'd have fewer of those, which is even better. And, you know, the other thing is this goes to building trust between police and communities to begin with. So communities, witnesses, victims cooperate with police, provide the information needed to solve crimes. And that's where we are seeing some really positive efforts, including engaging violence interrupters, who can sometimes be a bridge, you know, because they don't work for law enforcement, and many of them are former gang members themselves. Mm-hmm. They're able to build these relationships with the community and also diffuse some of these conflicts. I mean, most of the violence we see is interpersonal conflicts, whether it's between gangs, domestic violence, and so forth. And people's stress level went up during the pandemic. They were holed up. These types of prevention programs are very much in person, so they got suspended. But obviously the pandemic's in the rearview mirror. We can't make excuses. We need to solve more crimes and prevent more crimes.
I just want to follow up. Did I hear you say that during the pandemic, the crime rate went up during the pandemic or down?
Well, it's complicated. Now, shoplifting went down, right? And so I'll give you an example. Assaults went down, but aggravated assaults went up because you didn't have the bar fights. Those are assaults. You know, I hit someone in the bar, but aggravated assault with a gun, that's gone up, and domestic violence has gone up. So virtually every type of crime except auto theft in the last 2 years has gone down, but that doesn't mean every crime is still at the level that it was before the pandemic. Mm-hmm. You've got some isolated examples like Washington, D.C. and Memphis that have not seen the decline in the last few years where crime is.
Judith Sherwin has got another question for you.
Yeah. You talk about clearing crimes, the police department solving crimes, and those statistics are really pathetic, I have to tell you. Is the solution or partial solution to this stronger witness protection programs? Because there's a certain reluctance, I understand, in the community and in our communities to come forward and to testify because of the retaliatory factor of coming in and testifying against, an aggravated assaulter or potential murderer. What do you think about these witness protection programs and whether that could help some of these clearance issues?
I'm going to give you an opportunity to respond to that, Mark, but we do have to pause. Mark Levin will be back with an answer to that very important question. I'm Bruce Dumont. From coast to coast, border to border, and around the world, even on Memorial Day weekend, we are here speaking to you wherever you're listening. You may be in the barbecue, not in the barbecue, but you may be at the barbecue. You may be driving to the barbecue. You may be adding more sun lotion to your back. Whatever it is, I'm Bruce Dumont. Thanks for joining us tonight. Solve crime in America, you need people who see something to come up and say something, and that is a growing problem in the United States, where at least in the major areas, nobody in the neighborhood, despite crying and having balloon launches, frequently they have nothing to add to the police to help cure a crime. And again, also, as Judith mentioned before the break, there is this intimidation factor, where those people who may see something are afraid to say something because there will be some thug in some gang that's going to come down and either murder them or murder their family. So the question of any protection for a similar witness protection program at a local level that you've heard about at the national level. I mean, most people think of that as part of a federal crime where you're trying to put a mobster away. But this is a real issue in criminal justice reform. And is there anything going on to provide safe cover to those people who want to step up and point a finger, Mark?
Yes, there are some localities that do have witness protection programs, and there's research that indicates that they are beneficial. I've even seen housing vouchers, essentially, so someone who's in a, you know, apartment could be subsidized, at least their moving cost, to move to another apartment. I also think it's important for us to keep in mind that the data we've been talking about, crime going up or down, these are reported crimes. Now, there's a separate right. FBI study that's not published as often on victimization. And so there's this gap between the number of people who say they've been victimized and the number of crimes that are reported.
Well, and Mark, that kind of goes to my point that I've been wanting to ask you about this too, but I've heard that, I've read a couple of posts and things like that, and I don't know about deep research, but that one of the reasons that there's a so-called drop in crime in some of these areas, that some stuff just isn't being even reported or prosecuted anymore. It's like you call up a city and say, hey, I just got robbed. And they're like, well, is the guy still there? And is this happening or is that happening? And it's like, it just falls underneath the radar because nobody's doing anything about it. And I wanted to ask whether that is part of the issue. And then the other thing too, that, you know, coming back to how much of a, it's like, I'm not really a hawk. I just, as I've said before, in the last question I asked, like, I just want the bad people to get put away, and I'm not sure that that's happening as much as it should right now, and I don't know that the system is set up to do it anymore. I mean, what we've done the reverse. I think it's been kind of shown, and maybe you can shed some light on this, that Giuliani's, you know, stop and frisk and broken windows policing worked. Now, maybe it worked in concordance with certain demographics that were also put wind at its backs, but that if you go after the small stuff, you catch people that are ready to do the big stuff. And what we've done is we've actually done that in reverse now and said, no, we're not going to do anything about any of these people who do these things, like shoplifting under $900. That's like $900 theft, get out of free card. So what can we do about these things and reverse this process of stopping doing the things that already we know worked somewhat?
Mark?
Yeah, well, one thing I want to note is during the time that Giuliani was mayor, the population of Rikers Island actually went down. And so what happened is for people doing graffiti, jumping turnstiles, these quality of life misdemeanors that we're talking about, they were given warnings. They were given desk appearances. A desk appearance ticket, you go to the police precinct nearby and you agree to, you know, whatever, do community service or what have you. Some people obviously went on probation, which actually they do a very good job of in New York City. Having this population density makes it easier for a probation officer to manage his or her caseload. Mm-hmm. So there's, and of course it makes it easier for police to really, have their presence felt. You know, there was this whole anecdote about squeegee men, that drivers were irritated by squeegee men in New York City. And actually, it turned out to be like two squeegee men, so it was really easy to address. But all these people, there were tons of complaints about them.
With this stuff that's going on right now, let's sort of cut to the chase now. Has there been a movement anywhere in the United States that you are aware of where you have local political leaders standing up and saying, we've got to build more prisons? We need more space, because we read stories about overcrowding and federal and state judges demanding that the quality of life in prisons has got to improve. But is there anybody out there that's saying, let's build some more prisons, Mark?
Well, first of all, prisons do only last a certain amount of time, and they can reach a point where it's more expensive to repair than it would be to replace it. So building new prisons isn't necessarily, you know, a bad idea. It doesn't necessarily mean more people are
incarcerated. More jails. Do we need more jails?
Well, jails wear out even sooner, but Arkansas is an example. They're in the prison building mode, Mississippi and Alabama, or Alabama, not Mississippi, but Alabama approved plans for new prisons that billions of dollars. So, but again, a lot of it's being portrayed as it's going to be replacing antiquated prisons. So I think that, and again, it gets back to, do we have the people that need to be in prison for the appropriate amount of time versus, you know, do we just say, let's just lock everybody up or let's lock no one up?
Are there examples of alternatives to prison or jail that are operating anywhere in the United States that need to be expanded? Because you have done the research and there seems to be some success in these alternatives to incarceration.
Yes, well, and I mean, it also depends how you define incarceration. So obviously, there's probation departments, for example, often have community corrections facilities. And one of the advantages is they're in the area where people came from, so they can be much more effective in terms of reentry and getting a person connected to a job. You know, and of course, halfway houses, which some are better than others. There's those types of things. And of course, there's residential mental health and drug treatment programs. I don't think most people would consider those incarceration, but I think most people would agree that someone who's seriously mentally ill is better off in a mental health treatment program, which may be residential in some cases for at least a period of time versus being in jail. So, and then of course, within kind of the prison or jail context, you have North Dakota, which modeled one of their prisons off of Norway, where, you know, people are addressed on a first name basis. They have much better conditions and vocational opportunities. You also have emerging models for dealing with young adults, those who are 18 to 25, like in Massachusetts, that are very promising. These individuals have the highest recidivism rates, but many of them don't have a high school diploma, so there's a real need for a strong educational component, mm-hmm. and also continuing to work with family, because in some cases they may be living at home when they return. So it's a different population that they're very vulnerable, by the way, in a regular prison to physical and mm-hmm. sexual abuse. So I think there's a lot of different promising approaches that we're seeing.
Are we seeing them? I mean, I guess how widespread, how long does it take a success in North Dakota? How long does it take for that success to sort of permeate other surrounding states or get to the national level of attention?
Well, it's honestly, there's not a perfect way to measure that. No. I think that, but you know, what we do see is we've actually seen a real interest among staff in prisons in improving conditions. It affects them, too. I mean, in Texas, for example, we actually finally put in about $60 to $80 million in the last year or two to air condition at least a third of the prisons that weren't air conditioned. Mm-hmm. And we're approaching the summer of over 100 degrees. And so you can imagine, even for people that don't care about those who are incarcerated, for the staff, it's brutal as well. And I think there's a greater understanding now that having decent conditions is goes hand in hand with the programming, because, for example, if you have overcrowding and people sleeping in the day room, you can't run your programs. So there's research about what works, cognitive behavioral therapy, for example, in programs both behind bars and not behind bars. But if you don't have the staff in place without heavy turnover and you don't have conditions that are at least humane, you're not going to get the results from those programs that the research says you can.
Is there still an ongoing problem of finding the future, correctional officers? Is there a shortage of people that want to go into that field?
Absolutely. And of course, police officers as well, as yes. you know, but it's actually worse for correctional officers. Obviously, you know, I think we all know there's like, you know, young people who grow up and want to be a cop.
Yeah.
You don't hear that as much as it relates to, yeah.
Yeah.
So it's a big challenge. And one of the common issues is, you know, exposure to violence and stress. Correctional officers have a much shorter lifespan, about 10 years shorter than the average mm-hmm. American. So wellness programs that are important and to ensure they have sufficient time off. And it can be a vicious cycle, because if you don't have enough staff, then they do overtime. And so then these folks are not really taking care of themselves.
Right. Yeah, and you've got then obviously unions are growing and have more support. And again, sometimes they're asking or demanding things that don't make sense. They make sense to their membership, but they may not make sense to the budget constraints of a state. When we come back again, I think we're learning here as this program unfolds. we're learning that the criminal justice reform that a lot of people were very positive about, there still is a lot more work, to be done. And we'll continue our conversation. And when we come back, I want to talk about illegal immigrants and how much do they contribute, if at all, to rising crime rates. Back shortly. Back. This is our final segment of our broadcast this evening. And again, before the break, I asked Mark Levin, who joins us from Texas this evening, the illegal immigration issue has raised the issue of whether or not illegal immigrants are raising or involved in any part in the rising crime rate, the perceived rising crime rate in America. Do we have any evidence to make that case for or against, Mark?
Well, the best research, and this was a study that looked at undocumented immigrants from 2012 to 2018 in Texas, and they were less likely than U.S.-born citizens to be arrested for violent crimes, drug crimes, and property crimes.
Okay.
Now the composition of illegal immigration certainly has changed since 2018, so a lot of the data we have is old. And, of course, the other thing to keep in mind is you can have – you know, you have people coming from all over the world, not just Mexico or Latin American countries. And, of course, we all remember 9/11. And so just a small number of, you know, terrorists can do incredible amount of damage.
Right.
So I think, you know, certainly having a secure border makes sense for a whole host of reasons. But on the specific issue of street crime, undocumented immigrants are less likely than native-born Americans. But the other thing is the disorder, right? I mean, if people are sleeping on the street in, you know, New York, Chicago, and, of course, some of those were put on buses from Texas, as we know. But that is unnerving to a community. And when you have huge numbers arriving, you know, in a very small period of time, it's really hard for any services to, whether it's housing, education, medical care, for that to match up with the demand.
Mark, a question. You obviously live in and do your work in Texas, and we're on several radio stations in Texas. Is Governor Abbott's position about putting illegal immigrants on buses and sending them to northern cities, is that popular within the state of Texas? Is that a popular position that he takes?
It's quite popular. There have been a few polls that have asked about that here, even independents, and I think it showed 30% or 40% of Democrats in Texas. I mean, obviously it's shifting what's perceived to be a burden.
Right.
And, you know, as you know, they can't work under federal law. So a lot of these folks who do want to work, that's been a major point of contention that, unless they get TPS status, like Venezuelans did, they're not able to get a job as a dishwasher or anything else, so they can't pay their own freight, even though most of them would like to do that.
Well, I've said on this program, I think that he deserves some sort of an award, because what he has done is he's nationalized the issue by basically sending illegal immigrants to cities around the United States. It has created a great burden in each of those cities. We are a receiving city in Chicago, and we deal with it, you know, on a daily basis here. But again, I think it was the right thing to do, because if not, you know, half of the political leadership in the country would still be asleep at the switch that this is a real problem. And it's affecting people because of a lack of security at the border. It is affecting life in New York, Chicago, Los Angeles, and Lincoln, Nebraska. So it is something that that I'm glad that you're giving us some clarification on. One other thing, Donald Trump says repeatedly in his speeches that the illegal immigrants are coming from prisons, mental institutions. The asylums and prisons have been released in these countries, and they're releasing all of their prisoners, and those are the people that are coming to the country. Is there any evidence at all that these five or six countries from which most of these immigrants are coming from, is there any evidence that they're releasing their prisons and their mental institutions?
Not that I'm aware of. I think the issue really is this instability and really terrible governments in many of these countries. And right. Most people are fleeing for their safety from gangs. And to be honest, some are fleeing for economic reasons as well. I think that really it just points to the need to figure out how we can and our ability to do this is very limited, but to encourage, the rule of law, the institutions that are needed to have more effective governance in these countries.
Judith Sherwin.
Yeah, I think there is one statistic that Donald Trump has been quoting lately in a number of his rallies, which is, when he says they're letting people out of prisons and they're sending their criminals here. The crime has gone down significantly in Venezuela. What have you heard about that?
Have you heard anything about that?
Your
jurisdiction, Mark, but go ahead.
I mean, it's even been fact-checked that it's actually true. Fact-checked so have you heard
whom?
Any? Oh, you know, the usual fact-checkers, whoever they are.
But let me ask you, Judith, I want to ask you. You are obviously a partisan for Donald Trump.
Absolutely.
Do you, when he says that on the stump,
yeah.
Do you really believe him?
On that one?
Yeah.
I actually looked it up, and I've read it in several places.
Yeah, I think you're thinking of El Salvador with President Bukele, who's rounded up a lot of people.
Well, no, he actually didn't mention El Salvador, but it's probably true there, too. But he mentioned Venezuela.
I think he was probably referring to Bukele rather than Maduro.
Well, can I just jump in on that? Because I mean, Bukele hasn't been sending his criminals here.
Right.
He's been building massive prisons and putting every single person who he thinks might be guilty of something in the past in jail. And it appears to be working there. I don't know about crime having gone down someplace else, but I just got to say this is. You know, this is one of those things, it's been a very enlightening hour because we've got to do something about this so we can put the people who belong in prison and let the people who don't belong in prison out.
Right.
On that note.
Well, let me say this.
Good. Last word to you. Go ahead, Mark. 10 seconds.
Yeah, well, just because he's put hundreds of people on trial at once, but it does show people will turn to authoritarian solutions if we don't control crime in sensible ways.
Okay. Criminal Justice, the Council on Criminal Justice is the organization, and the Chief Policy Officer, has been with us, Mark Levin. Mark, thank you very much for being with us, not only on tonight's show, bringing us up to date, but also on your numerous appearances in the past on the criminal justice reform issues. So thanks very much for joining us from Texas tonight. Also, our thanks to Judith Sherwin. She has been here. Also, Bruno Barron, and earlier in the broadcast, Dan Johnson. I'm Bruce Dumont. Thank you very much for joining us. Fritz Goldman helped make this program possible. Until next week, good night from Chicago.